You're listening to Bigfoot Live, starring Thomas Gardy, the world's most respected authority on the phenomena known as Bigfoot. Sit back and relax as we take you on a journey into the world of the unknown. Believer or skeptic, man or woman, you will be mesmerized by real people telling real descriptions about real encounters. Fasten your seatbelts, America. It's reality radio at its finest, and it starts now.
In 1967, my whole life changed. I saw the Roger Patterson film on the Johnny Carson show. And I gotta tell you, that's the day I thought I was gonna challenge the world and go out and go find this thing.
We had found like 12 tracks in the ground. I didn't want to believe it was Bigfoot.
There he is.
He's moving right now. He's moving right now. He's straight out the tree line. He's moving to the right. He's going to the right. He's going into the tree right now. Come here, look.
I'm Omar, and I'm a reporter with ABC television and Tyler Lungian. It's been my pleasure with Tom Scotty and his team tonight. I have to admit that I was skeptical. When I came out here, I thought we at this time in our history, had the technology to be able to find one of these things if it existed. But after seeing the footprints and the dig marks in the sand, what I believe to be a very large creature running at a high rate of speed through the woods, convinced me I had to change my opinion.
I turned, I saw this thing standing by my gator.
When I saw the actual footprints, I realized they were something special and probably Sasquatch.
When I landed on the ground, I was kind of thinking, this ain't no human being. It's got to be something else.
www.searchingforbigfoot.com.
Alice wants what you think I've seen. Something strange, you know. Sasquatch sitting on the side of his knee, and he was talking to Moccasin Joe. Well, the party gonna have out in the St. John's Wall.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Marco Bill on the Bigfoot Live broadcast. And folks, it's that time of the week again. It's time for the Wednesday evening Bigfoot Live radio show with our host, Mr. Tom Biscardi. And now, everybody, the man who put the big back into Bigfoot, our host and renowned Bigfoot researcher, Mr. Tom Biscardi. Good evening, Tom. How are you tonight?
Well, what do you think, man? I'm better than the average bear, boo-boo. I'm feeling like $1 million.
Well, let me tell you who's on tonight there, Tom. We got Leroy. Anthony is listening. We got Greg. We got Rocky. We got Michael. We got Sarah listening. And TJ. Our friend Scott didn't make it. I don't know what happened, but he didn't dial in.
Scott Luca?
Yeah. I talked to him a couple hours ago, so I don't know.
Okay. So he doesn't know how to get in.
No, he knows.
I know, but he's not up there now.
No. He might have overslept or something, too. I don't know. It's 10 o'clock his time.
Listen. Okay. All right. Well, let's. I want to talk to the people around the globe, Marco, about the excitement. The buzz is the word.
Yes.
The buzz, and the buzz right now, ladies and gentlemen, is beware, people. Whoever had anything to do with the Roger Patterson film, that fake film, the FAKE film, look out, because we are coming. That's right. We're coming to get you. is a real easy way to get, you know, to solve this quotation, folks. Come clean! Come clean, mofo! Real simple. All you need to do is to come out and say, hey, I'm no good, and I lied. That's what you need to do. That's what I'm looking for, okay? I was a part of this elaborate hoax for almost 50 years, folks. That's what those people did. And I'm tired of it. We're going to expose them all. We've got all the evidence. Look out. We're coming. We are coming. That's for damn sure. And, you know, I got to tell you something, ladies and gentlemen. Right now, between this wacky weather we're having across this country, look out. Oh, my gosh. Flooding. Tornadoes. Inclement weather. It is all nutso. Yeah, that's right. And guess what? I get a call at 1:30 this morning. Guy's in Georgia going down the freeway. Bam! Slam! Alakazam! He hits a creature. He didn't want to come on. He's scared to Dickens. He can't believe what he did. Didn't believe in Bigfoot. But he hit one. We'll get to the bottom of that. One of the guys that we're going to go to up in New Hampshire is supposed to be on tonight. He's already been documented. He's been on one of those shows. Bunch of craziness. He knows what's going on. He was on the phone with me for about an hour yesterday, telling me everything that was going on and all the people that were out there and all the people that had seen the creature and all the action that's going on in New Hampshire. We're going to be there. Another place was good old AK, the White Mountains in Arizona, the Apache Nation. They're waiting for us. Whole bunch of good old good ones out in that area. Well, the creatures have come down from the mountains, and they've been knocking on people's doors. Knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door. Remember that, Michael, back when we were in Nam? Well, everybody, if they weren't out there leading with a rifle in their hands, they were smoking marijuana in Nam, folks. It was probably the craziest days of a lot of people's lives. But nevertheless, it's happening. They are on the move. We are going to be there, and we are going to document it to the world. They're doing a feature story on us about our company going public, about us outing the Patterson film. Not many people had the cojones to do what we're going to do, but we're going to do it. You know us. We're not going to take no bullshit. We're going to do one thing, and that's explain to the world and bring the truth forward. Let everybody know that they've been faked, F-A-K-E-D, for almost 50 years, folks, come next year. And we're not going to stand for it anymore. We're not on that damn money train as all these other people have been. And all these people that in the scholastic world, folks, think about that. Huh? We've got people in college sitting there telling, oh, well, this is a real film. This is a real creature. Well, I'd like to know how they got their PhD. Was it in the Cracker Jack box? What do you think, Marco Bill?
Well, I don't know. You know, I tell you, there's a lot of stuff out there that's unexplainable, and it certainly can't explain people's minds. I think there's quite a few nutty people out there.
You mean crazies? A bunch of crazies? A bunch of nutsos?
Yeah, I'm getting all kinds of Facebook and email stuff. You know, they don't want to. Most of these people don't even know anything about the film at all, other than they watched the whole, well, probably a little segment of it on TV or something, and they read some article that somebody investigated with, I guess our scientific community investigated, so they think that that's all the gospel, but nobody's really dug into anything other than Leroy and Greg, and they really kind of tore it apart.
It's all a bunch of shit. I'm so tired of it. But you know what? It's coming to a close, folks. It's all over. That's right. Finito. Finale. Because Searching for Bigfoot crew, we're out there, and we're going to be knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door. Don't forget it. Let's get out there to my good old good buddy out there in NC. That's right, North Carolina. Mikey, you out there?
Yes, I am.
Well, how you doing tonight, young man?
Just fine, thank you. Just fine. Sitting here listening to you go on and on. But, yeah.
You know what? There was a song. On and on, on and on, on and on. Do you remember who did it?
On and on. No, I don't. And I'm
pretty
sure.
Nor do I. And who cares? Well, I got to tell you something, brother. What an amazing day today. Ladies and gentlemen, he's on the East Coast. I'm on the West Coast. Those of you who know me, I'm up very early every morning, 5 o'clock, 4:45. And, you know, he and I talk because when it's 5 o'clock my time, it's 8 o'clock his time, he's got his feet propped up on his table. He's drinking his cup of Joe. And if I know him, he's probably smoking his cigarette. And he's getting and delving into those books that he does. This is the author, ladies and gentlemen. That's right. Sasquatch for Sale. He outs all those ding-a-lings that we've talked about here, there, and everywhere else. And it's amazing because I talked to Michael this morning. I says, hey, man, I had a conversation with this guy, Scott Luca, from New Hampshire, and he was telling me about his experience with the people from Finding Bigfoot. He says, really? He says, tell me about it. Share it with me, Tom. So I proceeded to tell Michael about the whole thing about, he says, this guy Luca tells me, he says, Tom, these guys came out and they were all stoned. He said, you should have seen the pupils of their eyes. He says, you couldn't believe it. And he says, they were all following a script. So I tell you, ladies and gentlemen, how can you follow a script looking for a creature that no one really, the scientific world anyway, most of them, don't believe is true? And here these guys are out there finding Bigfoot, but never find it, because if they find it, there will be no more show, especially when they're doing it to a script that they have to follow. Can you enlighten us about that, Michael?
Yeah, I can. Way back when Finding Bigfoot first went on, I was featured on the second segment they ever made, which was called Compelling Evidence. And that involved the 3-minute thermal video that I shot down in the Uari National Forest in North Carolina years back. And I had taken that thermal video to the then friend of mine, Matt Moneymaker, who's head of the BFRO and the shining star of Finding Bigfoot. So I appeared on the show, and there's parts of it I can't talk about because I did sign a non-disclosure agreement. But in general, I can say certainly that your observations about scripting are right on the button. And I don't know. I mean, there were a number of things over the week it took us to film the episode. Well, we just do the same stupid thing. All right, let's try that again over and over and over. Especially, and this is a familiar technique you see in a lot of these shows, but they really honed it fine in this. We'd be walking through the woods or looking at a tape or something like that, and then all of a sudden, and we would have to rehearse this. We'd go, "Whoa, what's that?" Or "Look at that!" Or "Holy Christ!" Something like we'd all make some, you know, message of excitement, and then it would cut, and then there'd be a commercial, and then we'd come back and we'd say, "Oh yeah, well it was just a raccoon in a tree," or whatever it was. But this went on over and over and over again. As far as general scripting is concerned, they led the story and told us what to say. It wasn't like a play or a movie where we were exactly, at least most of it, scripted literally word for word. We followed a storyline and pretty much winged it. And then when we didn't get it right to their satisfaction, they'd stop filming. But every time we talked, I mean, here we are out in the wilderness, and there's three guys with cameras, three guys with boom mics, two or three producers, and a couple of production assistants, all out of range of the camera, of course. So it gives the appearance that there's just a few guys in the woods. And actually, it's this crowd of people in the woods all going, shh, shh, be quiet, okay, they're going to start filming now, and everybody shut up, and we'd yap away for a few minutes. This show ran for 9 years, I believe, and I can't believe that they were able to come up with enough material to fill 9 years, especially when you don't find anything. And Tom's right, Tom. If you did find something, it'd be the end of the show, of course.
Told me, which was just shocking, but it just reiterated what I heard about in the beginning, because we were offered that show 10 years ago, I think.
Mm-hmm.
They said that the people on the show were subsidized by Matt Moneymaker's benefactor. Now, whoever that may be, I don't know. I've never met him. But I had said that to you when I first met you, and you really didn't know yourself.
Well, my hunch is somebody's got it wrong. It doesn't make any sense to me, and considering that benefactor who's a friend of mine, I for his sake, I'm not going to mention his name on the air, but he is definitely does not look favorably on Matt Moneymaker back then when the show started.
Yeah, and I understand that he doesn't look on him very well now, neither, does he?
Not at all.
Yeah, okay, gotcha.
Not at all.
All right, well, listen, let's go into a commercial real quick. Let's pay some bills, and then on the other side of the commercial, we're going to get into the meat and potatoes, ladies and gentlemen. That's right. We're going to be getting into the part where Philip Morris, my good buddy, married to that beautiful girl named Amy Morris, who made the suit, sold it to Roger Patterson, and Michael Green's going to tell us the whole story. So let's go to commercial. We'll see you on the other side.
1967, my whole life changed. I saw the Roger Patterson film on the Johnny Carson show. And I gotta tell you, that's the day I thought I was gonna challenge the world and go out and find this thing.
We had found like 12 tracks on the ground. I didn't want to believe it was Bigfoot.
There he is.
He's moving right now. He's moving right now. He's straight out the tree line. He's moving to the right. See him? He's going to the right. He's going into the trees. Right.
Look. I'm Bob Homarg, and I'm a reporter with ABC Television and Tyler Lundgren. It's been my pleasure to be with Tom Scotty and his team tonight. And I have to admit that I was skeptical when I came out here. I thought we at this time in our history, had the technology to be able to find one of these things if it existed. But after seeing the footprints and the dig marks in the sand and what I believe to be a very large creature running at a high rate of speed through the woods, convinced him I had to change my opinion on Bigfoot.
I turned, I saw this thing standing by my gator.
When I saw the actual footprints, I realized they were something special and probably Sasquatch.
Like landed on the ground, I'm kind of thinking, this ain't no human being. It's got to be something else.
Bigfoot lives a movie right now at www.searchingforbigfoot.com.
And we're back.
You know, ladies and gentlemen, when I get to hear these ditties, it gives me flashbacks. You know, I've been on most of the expeditions with us, and then I think about, you know, you cannot record, you can't script what we've seen. I've been just listening to Michael, of course, and we were talking about that Animal Planet show. That's the network called Finding Bigfoot, and it was scripted. And you know, if they didn't do it right, they had to cut and they had to go back again. And you know, here it takes to do one episode a whole week. We would do when you have boots on the ground, ladies and gentlemen. Boots on the ground means that you are there chasing one of these creatures. You are surveilling areas. You are in the brush. You are in the trees. And when I remember some of the times we were out there, you know, we're going to be starting our expedition in Arizona on the Apache reservation, the White Mountain Apaches. And, you know, they wrapped their arms around us with their hospitality. They gave us the hospitality of, I think it was 250,000 acres, and they entrusted their land and their people with us. This came from their chief, from their higher ups, their elders. And, you know, it was something that we built. It wasn't something that just came along in 1 minute. And now, of course, you know, they called upon us to be out there again. And the guy that won a Tony Award and rose in the ranks of the media, a guy named Scott Davis, he's can't wait for us to be there because he wants to find out more, of course, about the Patterson film. And he's going to spearhead this whole thing for us. He's going to do a 2 or 3 part special in Arizona. So that's all going to take place starts at the 7th of July. Mark your calendars, folks. The 7th of July. You'll already gone past the weekend's festivities coming up with Memorial Weekend. Of course, then it'll be 4th of July weekend. Then, of course, the summer starts, where the action starts all over the country, where people are out amongst the brush, having good old good ones, fishing, camping, being out in the woods, and that's when they start seeing the creatures, okay? And that's when the reports start coming through, fast and furious. Well, we are going to start there. We'll be there for 3-4 days, depending on what kind of evidence we've got, and where they're going to be filming us. We'll be on TV, we'll be on radio, we'll be on it all, just like we did before, okay? But now we're coming back stronger than ever, and we're coming back with a vengeance. Okay, enough being said. The biggest, newest thing that's going to happen with SFBI under the new ownership of BPII, and our company will be going public just around that same time, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to tell you straight up, we are going after the people who perpetrated the hoax of the Roger Patterson film. We do have with us tonight, in the background, will be Philip and Amy Morris, and my good buddy Michael Green is going to be talking. We've met all together, and because of right now, Michael is going to be answering questions and telling us the story. So, it all started, ladies and gentlemen, supposedly back in October of 1967 that Roger Patterson took this film. He found out that it was bogus, it was bullshit. It happened before then, and before that he went ahead and contacted a guy that had costumes at the time, that was making costumes for studios and for sideshows and circuses and whatnot. Contacted a guy named Philip Morris, and that's not the cigarette company. It's a guy that's been around and knows what he's doing. So I'm going to turn it to you. I'm going to give you the stage, Michael. Why don't you tell us the story as you know it and as you heard it through Philip Morris and through the readings of the book of Mr. Greg Long?
I'd be glad to. I think the Philip and Amy Morris story it's such a great story that it really, really deserves a 30 seconds of background, because they are such an interesting and nice couple. They got married right out of high school sweethearts, and he hit the road as a traveling magician, and they were following the only old guys are going to remember this, a Western show named Lash LaRue. And they used to have black and white movies of him. He was a famous cowboy movie star. He always dressed in black, and he had a bullwhip. That was his signature. Anyway, they were going along with the Lash LaRue show when they got to Charlotte, North Carolina, where I live, and they ended up staying behind in Charlotte and are still there. This was back in, 1955, and they started a small costume shop there. This costume shop has grown from something in their basement with Amy at the sewing machine and Philip designing stuff, to the nation's largest costume company. And when I say large, you can't believe how big it is. The building looks like an automobile assembly plant. It's a million square feet. It's absolutely enormous. Anyway, to cut to the chase here, back in 1960s, when he was just starting up this business, Philip was making gorilla suits himself, one at a time, with the help of Amy and a couple of other people, and selling them, because magicians at the time had something called the Girl and the Gorilla Act, where on stage a pretty girl would be dragged screaming and shoved into a cage. They'd pull the curtain back, and a gorilla would leap out of the cage, run down through the audience. Nobody expected it. Everybody would scream and run and get all excited. He was making the suits for this act, which was quite popular throughout the country. And he was the only one making these suits, with the exception of the Hollywood studios for Planet of the Apes types, who of course had their own producers. But for the magician trade, Philip was the only guy who was making these suits. And he said it would take him about a week or two to make one. It wasn't easy. And they used a special fabric that he'd found called Dynel, D-Y-N-E-L, which was a nylon fake hair. And you would see it on, bathroom rugs and toilet seat covers and this sort of stuff. But Philip saw it, and he said, hey, that looks like fur. And so he got a hold of some of this stuff and started sewing up gorilla suits. And, just sewing them up sounds easy, but this involved all kinds of casting heads, feet, and hands out of plaster of Paris, making molds, and then making the final out of pouring latex in there, and it's a very involved creative process. But you end up with a pretty good looking suit, and these suits were advertised in a magazine whose name escapes me at the moment, but it was something like Amusement Business. Amusement Business is a trade magazine for carnivals, magicians, magic shows, vaudeville, rodeos, that kind of thing. And it sells it has articles about various stuff in the amusement trade, including a whole lot of stuff on rodeo stars. Hence, Roger Patterson, who was a rodeo cowboy, young, short, very, very strong guy, was in the rodeo business, if you will, part-time. He didn't really do much of anything full-time. And he would have had a chance to come across this magazine, which had a full-paid ad from the struggling Philip Morris Company, featuring gorilla suits. So one day, Philip And I, by the way, I have to add here, I spent an afternoon and evening with Philip and Amy Morris with Tom Biscardi and toured their factory, had dinner with them, and absolutely delightful, straightforward, honest, obviously honest as the day is long, and not to belabor the point, but money could not possibly be the object of Philip Morris claiming that this was his suit. The last thing this guy needs is more publicity. When you own the largest costume company in the United States, you don't have to tell fibs. Anyway, he gets a phone call in the summer of 67, and it's a guy named Roger Patterson. And he says, do you have gorilla suits? And Mr. Morris said, yeah, are you a magician? And he said, no, I'm a rodeo cowboy. Now, when he said this to Morris, Morris had never heard, of course, nobody had heard of Roger Patterson. And when Morris told the story to Greg Long, the author of the book, The Making of Bigfoot, Morris made it a point to say, you know, that Patterson had announced himself as a rodeo cowboy, which was something that Morris would not have known at the time. Anyway, he said, well, what do you want the suit for? And he said, oh, we're just going to play a joke. So they went back and forth. Now, at the time, Patterson had, well, at the time, for his whole life, Patterson had the reputation of being a guy who really never wanted to work a 9-to-5 job. He'd pick up a job here or there for a week or two, and then he'd go do something else and one thing and another. He was always scheming and conniving and hopping from one job to another and borrowing money here and there and never paying it back. And anyway, he was kind of a nice guy, but ne'er-do-well. I wouldn't say he was mean but he was just kind of shiftless. So he said to Philip, listen, why don't you send me the suit, and if I like it, I'll send you a check. If I don't like it, I'll send it back. That sounds, as you come to know Roger Patterson, very much like Patterson. And Philip Morris said, no, that he laughed and said, well, listen, rather than sending in the suit, why don't you send me the money, and I'll send you the suit, and if you don't like it, then you send it back to me, and I'll send you your money back. And Patterson said, oh, well, all right. At this point, Patterson had gone off and borrowed, I believe it was $700 or so, from a woman named Vilma. I don't recall her last name. But anyway, for once, Patterson had some money in his hand. So the money arrived, and Philip sent him the suit. And the suit, he went on to describe to us in great detail, Morris did, about how it was made with this Dynel fabric, how the feet were made out of neoprene that he cut out, the soles of the feet, and how the head was fashioned out of a mold that he made. And then he added that he had no idea, he thought Patterson was just going to go, he forgot about the suit. And months later, he's watching TV at night with his wife, and all of a sudden, big news from Bluff Creek, California, Roger Patterson's just taken a film of a Sasquatch. And, of course, it is big news. And everybody, whoa, look at that baby walking across Bluff Creek. And Morris, watching this movie on TV, bursts out laughing and says, Amy, come on in here. Look, you got to see this. There's that guy I sold the suit to, and he's got somebody walking along in my suit. And Amy came in and started laughing. She said, yeah, that's right, it is that suit. Amy having been the one who was sitting down in the basement with the sewing machine, putting parts of it together. So they both knew exactly what the suit looked like and that nobody else was making these suits at the time. Philip went into great detail about how the suit was made, but he did say that the face that Philip Morris made looked like a gorilla. It was a gorilla suit. And the face, he said, but the face in the film wasn't the face of the head that I sold him. And he said he must have changed it, and that the head itself, minus the face, if you will, was padded, latex padded with some foam rubber to give it some thickness and substance. So it was sort of like a big, soft helmet covered with fake hair that came down and hung like a cape, sort of short cape around your shoulders and blended in with the rest of the suit. He said that Patterson must have cut out the gorilla face and replaced it with one of his own. And the author who was interviewing him, Greg Long, pointed out that, which is, this is quite well known, that Roger Patterson was a very good artist, and he could draw horses jumping, people riding broncs, sort of. He was a very accomplished artist. He loved to work in leather. He had a workshop behind his house in the barn. He liked working in leather. He liked making things by hand, and he knew how to draw. If there was anybody that could create a mask that would look less like a gorilla and more like a cross between a gorilla and a person, it would have been Roger Patterson. And Morris speculated that, well, he probably made this thing out of latex, which is easy enough to do if you read up on it. You can buy the latex and the plaster anywhere, and then had cut the gorilla's face out and had this latex mask put fastened back into the rest of the helmet-like head. Patterson had called a few weeks after he sent him the suit. Patterson had called him again and asked Amy, Philip Morris's wife, if I remember correctly, if they had any more of that Dynel, because he needed a few more scraps of it. And they scrounged around, and they found some more of it. And anyway, they subsequently sent him some more fur. And when you look at the Patterson film, you can see that the face has fur on it here and there. It's not completely covered with fur, but it's not completely bare like a gorilla's face. Then Morris went on to describe the feet and how the feet were made. They were like big slippers with neoprene, the sole that he had cut out, they fastened on the bottom to give it some sort of substance so you could walk. But you couldn't walk heel to toe quite like we do. You had to sort of reach forward with your leg and plant your foot more flat on the ground rather than letting the heel fall down first. And he explained that it was like people wearing clown costumes because the size of the foot extended out about 14 inches. So beyond the front of your toes, there was another 2 or 3 inches of foot. And if you tried walking in a regular manner, you'd stumble. So you had to kind of adopt this odd-looking walk, which you see this famous Sasquatchy walk in the film, which has subsequently been described as just the way Bob Hieronymus walks anyway, Bob Hieronymus being the guy who came, Roger Patterson's friend and neighbor who came forward and admitted to wearing the suit in the film. He happens to walk that way pretty much anyway, and it's a rather odd-looking walk. But you have to plant your foot fairly flat on the ground, otherwise you're going to stumble. And then as you step forward, your foot goes back, you have to sort of raise it up a little higher than a normal person only raises their foot up, maybe 40, 45 degrees. In the Patterson film, the rear foot gets raised up quite a bit higher repeatedly. And my theory is that was to, in effect, stretch the suit back, if you will, and pull the foot back into the rear of the slipper thing that he was wearing to sort of reseat it. And it really had nothing to do with trying to, quote, imitate a Sasquatch walk, because nobody knows what a Sasquatch walks like. Nobody certainly has it on film. This Patterson film has established a sort of, well, this is what they all walk like, of course. Well, yeah, okay. Show me some other films where it walks like that. I've seen a lot of supposed Sasquatch films myself, and usually they're running. So I, in all fairness, I can't say that I've seen them walking like that. The one that I saw through the thermal imager myself in the Uwari was walking sideways. It was walking slowly and deliberately, and it was swinging its arms. I watched it for about 5 seconds before I realized that I didn't have my digital video recorder running. So I put it down to turn that on. When I put the camera back up, it was gone. Subsequently, and I got the longer thermal video, you don't see it really walking at all because it's facing you. But anyway, the subject of how Philip Morris made this suit, and then when he saw it on TV, he didn't run off to the press and say, "Hey, that's my suit." And the author Greg Long asked him, "Well, why didn't you go public with this?" And Philip said, "Well, you know, I'm a professional magician, and I make." At the time, I made stuff for other magicians, and it just isn't done. You don't out other people's tricks and their stage shows and expose them as fakes. That just isn't the way this business runs. Everybody has their own little tricks, and how they do them. Of course, some other magicians will know it, and the people who make the tricks know it. But they don't run around telling everybody about it. So he said, "I just thought this was a hoax and it would just blow over, so I kept my mouth shut." And he kept his mouth shut for, oh gosh, 10 or 20 years. And then finally, I think it was Fox TV was doing a show, something, I may have this wrong, but he finally came forward and said, "Look, I did make this suit." And that's where it sits. And when you go to Philip Morris's factory, it's really what I'd have to call it, in the showroom area, there's a whole lot of rooms full of every kind of costume you've ever seen in your life, from Alien to Transformers to whatever. Anyway, there's sort of a Bigfoot corner, and there's a great big, 9 foot tall Bigfoot, very realistic in the corner. And then next to it, there's a table with half a dozen various sort of concepts of Bigfoot heads. And then next to that, there's a chair. And in that chair, draped over that chair, is an empty dark brown Bigfoot suit, or gorilla suit, excuse me. Philip pointed that out to me, and he said, that is exactly the kind of suit that I sold Roger Patterson. Those are the ones that Amy and I were making back then in the mid-60s. Sitting next to that suit was a chair with a set of old football shoulder pads. Now, the shoulder pads enter into this costume controversy very interestingly, because people have said, well, how could this animal move this realistically when it had such long arms, and the elbow, if it was just a human with extensions on their hands to make the arms hang longer, then the upper arm would appear a whole lot shorter in relation to the lower arm. But in the film, that isn't the case. And Philip explained that, well, if you add 3 inches to the top of the shoulders, I'm saying 3 inches, but roughly 3 inches to the top of the shoulder with shoulder pads, and then you add 3 inches to the bottom of the fingertips by extending it down with a fake hand, which the real hand sort of got its fists, they shoved in the wrist area of the fake hand, the elbow proportionally remains right in the middle. And when that arm bends, the upper arm and the forearm remain in proportion and look natural. But it's only because the shoulders have been raised in proportion. It was a very interesting detail, and I looked at this suit rather closely because, I've been interested in this stuff for like 20 years, and here I am sitting at the holy grail of Bigfootery, which is the Roger Patterson film, which, like Tom, I had, you know, sort of grown to know and love in my innocence. And now I'm looking at this suit. I ran my hands across, picked it up a little bit, ran my hands through the fur. When you get your hands on it, it's obviously not real fur, but it certainly looks like real fur. And the eye sockets were pretty big. And Philip explained, not to me, but he explained in the book that Patterson had complained to him that when he put the head on, that you could see the whiteness of the eyes of the person who had the head on. And Morris explained to Patterson, well, the trick, what you do here is you get some black makeup and you put it, rub it all over your the eye area of the person that's wearing the mask, and then you have them shut their eye, and this is an interesting little detail, you have them shut their eyelids and paint their eyelids black too, so that when they blink, you don't get these little flashes of white. Well, that seemed to have worked pretty well for this film, though at some point when after Patterson cut the face, the gorilla face off and made his own, he arranged the eyes in such a way that you don't see holes with a human eye behind it. You really don't see much of anything because it's kind of far away and blurry. What you do see, interestingly enough, is when Patty makes her famous turn to look back at Patterson, who's supposedly running around with the camera frantically filming, you see a glint in the right eye. Now, that glint, according to Bob Hieronymus, who's a big guy back then who wore the suit, Bob Hieronymus has a glass eye. He lost his right eye in an accident way before this film was shot. And when they were making the...
Michael dropped off the air, Tom.
Okay, so I think what he was trying to say, ladies and gentlemen, is I've been so close to this film and heard it so many different times, is every time the thing would turn around, in the case that he's talking about is that one where the creature looks back at the people filming him, the sun caught the right eye and it glistened off of that phony eye, the prosthesis that Roger Patterson asked Hieronymus to bring. So that was probably one of the biggest giveaways on the whole thing. I think between that and the tear in the by the hip and the foot, ladies and gentlemen, when he goes up in that famous film and that one clip, I think it was 365, I don't remember offhand, but you just see nothing but flat pad, and it blows your mind. You stop and say to yourself, wow.
It's Michael Green back on a new phone.
Hey, buddy, yeah, I was just filling in for you about the glistening in the eye, about the
prosthesis
that Hieronymus had, and then I was just talking about the foot on the pad there,
mm-hmm.
which everybody, you know, says, oh, wow, well, what can this be? Well, what can it be? It's a suit, and it's the bottom of the suit, which is just plain, and as you can see, it's a different color, isn't it? Oh,
yeah,
boy,
it is.
Right. And you've seen it there as well as I did. And I have to comment, you have made, Philip, in my opinion, Philip Morris and Amy Morris very proud. When I listened to you tonight, it's just been blowing me away. I'm thinking to myself, wow, you have either a photogenic memory or you're reading something verbatim, and I know you're not because you're ad-libbing what you heard, because I was there also. An excellent job, my friend. Without any further ado, let's bring in some couple of people here who are very close to this film, as we are in our own rights, and one is Greg Long, who wrote the book, The Making of Bigfoot, and the other guy is Leroy Blevins, who's the one that kind of tore it apart, did the anatomy of the damn thing. And he goes through films and can tell you what was spliced, what wasn't, and what it was all about. But first, let's get Greg. Greg, you out there?
Yes, I am.
What did you think of? Was this compelling to you this evening about the way he told?
Yeah, I want to give kudos to Michael Green for, you know, his narrative there of exactly what Philip Morris told me. He certainly is a very attentive listener, Michael, and it was a very good job. Yep, that's the things that Philip Morris told me. And by the way, he told me that more than once. It wasn't just one interview over the phone. It was several, because as I went back and looked at my poor copy of this film, and some stills, some of the still photographs taken from it, I had additional questions, and he had some wonderful answers for that. So, yes, that's very, very accurate. You know, of course, I wish we had that suit today. I don't know where it is, unless Patty Patterson has it in a steam trunk somewhere, steamer trunk, or it's been destroyed. But because that's been a criticism, of course, of the disbelievers in my book and Philip Morris's story. But, you know, if you're going to pull a hoax off, I wouldn't probably want to keep the evidence very long.
That's very true. But to answer your question, there was a family member of the Patterson family that supposedly knew the story. And now this is going back years, years ago, folks. So I'm going to try to remember and dust off the cobwebs. Is that a family member was to take the suit and cross the border into Canada. And there was somebody there that either was going to buy it, store it, hide it, whatever. I just don't remember. But that was the last that I had heard where the suit was, okay?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Of course, Canada, I guess John Green lives up there in Canada.
Oh, that name keeps surfacing, pray tell. I wonder yep. why. You know, here's another gentleman, ladies and gentlemen, that I have not met. I loved his books. They came in green. They came in red back in the 60s because I was one of them that purchased them back then. And they were these big flat books, ladies and gentlemen, took big pictures, okay? And I'm a picture guy. I don't like to read. But they say a picture describes 1,000 words. And it blew my mind because of the guy who I was involved with at the time. John Green tried to hire him, as well as Peter Byrne hired him, as well as Walt Disney, Lowell Thomas. These are big names, folks. You know, so this guy must be doing something right for these people to hire him. And yes, he was a wild game tracker, and he was good at what he'd done. He also was a game warden up in Alaska. So apparently the man knew what he was doing. So this John Green guy, and I don't like to talk about people that I've never met, but, you know, when you find out that he was actually in that filming sequence, you can actually see him out there in the foliage of the trees. Leroy, are you on with us?
Yes, I'm here, Tom.
Tell the folks out there in Bigfoot Land where approximately or what part of the movie that you saw John Green's torso.
Okay, I was in a part where they went from Bigfoot start walking, and you can actually see an image come across the camera, in front of the camera, and bend down. That was John Green.
That was John Green.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And approximately what time period? We know it wasn't the 20th of October, 1967. Was this film taken?
It was around Labor Day week when there wasn't nobody around in that area, because they have 3 days of filming where there wasn't nobody around.
Okay. You know, here's something that nobody has ever talked about, because they're so caught up in this holy grail, as Michael put it, is let me ask you something common sense-wise. If we saw a gorilla, folks, think about this for a minute now. Just think about it, okay? If you saw a gorilla, a primate, an unknown primate in the woods, and if you were that gorilla or that primate, that unknown primate, and you saw a bunch of guys on horseback coming towards you and yelling, screaming, whatever, it wasn't talking, there was no talkies back in them days, unless you had the 35 millimeter or 70, whatever the hell it was. But nevertheless, if you were that creature, would you just jolly across that woods or that stream or that beachfront? Would you do that the way that creature did, or would you hightail it out of there like a primate does? Think about it, folks, because not many people talk about that. Why is that, Greg Long?
Well, they don't want to talk about any of these things because, unfortunately, when it came to the film, the media just bought it, I guess, as entertainment or an oddity or something that would make a good story, sold newspapers. Certainly was used thereafter rather quickly in numerous documentaries, which I think Leroy has a good handle on all of those. There's a lot of issues of the film itself. Why would it be that men on horseback? I don't know how a gorilla would react to a horse. These horses certainly were making noises as they walked. They probably were snorting or whatever they were doing, and yet the Bigfoot just, as we know from Leroy's analysis of the film, the Bigfoot was really just sort of standing there, and rather than run, just sort of walked casually across the dry...
That's my point, Greg. You've seen silverbacks, you've seen chimps, you've seen regular gorillas. What do they do when they decide to take off?
Well, they lope off, don't they? They drag their arms on the ground, and I'm not an expert in their locomotion.
Do they walk away as Hieronymus did, or do they do it as a primate? That's my whole point here. And
that's
a primate turns.
Well, the thing about this Bigfoot image in the film is, as someone once told me, well, it's a piece of film number one, which of course isn't the Bigfoot itself, and number two, if you look at it, it looks like an upright walking man who has a lot of hair on him. So we don't know what's inside that hairy body there, but it's so much like a man, and there's so many explanations that Philip Morris has come up for why its arms are long and why it swings them the way it does. Of course, that is the way that Bob Hieronymus walked. It's just so very, very obvious. As you've indicated, there's two people that can finally shed light on this, and I guess your words were coming for you.
You bet, and thank you for that lead-in. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm telling you straight up, okay, Tom Biscardi and his crew will out the Patterson film within the next 6 months, and it'll be a blow-by-blow, and I'm not going to give up on it. You want to come and get me? You know where I'm at. You want to come serve me with some kind of papers? Please do. I would entertain that thought in a minute. I'd love to get you through discovery. I'd like to get you through depots, because that's all held as the truth and nothing but the truth. Can you say that real quick, Bob Gimlin and Patricia Patterson? We'll find out. Thanks to all my folks that are on the show tonight. Kudos and salutations. Till next time, America. Bye-bye.
Well, folks, once again, it's time to say so long. We'd like to thank Mr. Tom Biscardi and his guests and the Bigfoot team for joining us, and we'd especially like to thank you, our listeners, for tuning in. This is Marco Bill saying see you next Wednesday evening for some more Bigfoot Live radio show entertainment with Mr. Tom Biscardi and his team. And until then, keep the Bigfoot live and keep Bigfooting. See you next week.
Three men with a gold and a pact that they'd hold and a promise till the day that they died. Answers to the questions no one's found before. driving determination. The only key they had to unlock the door. Monster's mission is to be legend, anything, and facts. Well, together.